loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, today is Nakba Day, the day of catastrophe commemorated on May 15th by Palestinian people everywhere. We'll talk about the massacre that the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, committed against Palestinian protesters yesterday, the global reaction, and the history of Nakba Day. And then we continue our weekly series. Every Tuesday, we talk about the big economic issues. This segment called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism, takes place as a conversation with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, after the slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza yesterday, where over 60 people were killed and more than 2,700 wounded, protests erupted worldwide. We talk with someone at the protests in Israel, as well as an organizer of Washington, D.C. protests. Next, while the U.S. imposes economic sanctions on Iran, the UK and its European partners have prepared a package of initiatives to protect the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal, after the US withdrawal. The British, French, and German foreign ministers will meet with their Iranian counterpart to discuss the proposal. It's unclear when such a meeting would take place and what the initiatives include. Then, the U.S. and China are closing in on a deal that would give China's ZTE telecommunications company a reprieve from crippling sanctions in exchange for Beijing removing tariffs from billions of dollars worth of U.S. agricultural goods, especially soybeans. And then, the city of Seattle is introducing a new tax on large employers, namely Amazon, Starbucks, and Boeing, that will help fund programs for the homeless and for affordable housing. Amazon's multi-billionaire founder Jeff Bezos is furious and is threatening to reconsider the company's large footprint in Seattle. And finally, what's the easiest way to get arrested for marijuana possession in New York? According to a New York Times analysis, you just have to be black or Hispanic. In fact, across the city, African Americans are arrested at 8 times the rate of whites. Hispanics are arrested at 5 times the rate of whites. And in Manhattan, the rates for African Americans increases to 15 times the arrests for whites. And in other headlines, voters in Pennsylvania are headed to the polls for primary elections that analysts say will have a major impact on the fight for control of the House of Representatives. Pennsylvania's notoriously gerrymandered House districts were redrawn by Supreme Court order earlier this year, giving Democrats an opportunity to pick up several seats. Idaho, Nebraska, and Oregon are also holding elections today. The Taliban has launched a major operation to capture the city of Farah, a provincial capital in western Afghanistan. Citing the Trump administration's escalation of the war, the group recently rejected peace talks and announced a new general offensive. The fighting in the city is ongoing. Gina Haspel, President Trump's nominee to be CIA director, wrote a letter last week to Senator Mark Warner that was published today, acknowledging that, quote, "the enhanced interrogation program is not one the CIA should have undertaken," unquote. This directly contradicts her Senate hearing testimony last week, where she did not make this clear and noted only that the agency had gotten valuable information from its torture program. Philip Morse is seeking approval for a new device called IQOS, I-Q-O-S, an electronic smoking device. The company is touting its improved health benefits, but it also has the capability to collect data on the smoking habits of its users. Philip Morris has commented that it doesn't intend to pull data from the devices unless there's a malfunction, but analysts point out that this rich data could be used for mapping out consumption habits and marketing far better to users. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion about Palestinian Nakba Day and the ongoing fallout from yesterday's killings carried out by Israeli forces. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Nakba Day, or the Day of Catastrophe, commemorated on May 15th, the day after Israel's Declaration of Independence. The day commemorates the estimated 700,000 Palestinians who were expelled or fled from their towns and villages, and the hundreds of Palestinian towns and villages that were depopulated and destroyed. At least 60 Palestinians were killed yesterday and thousands wounded in demonstrations in Gaza, during the U.S. Embassy opening in Jerusalem. We're joined from Amman, Jordan, by Ali Abunima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Ali, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you very much.
Ali, a big part of what we're doing today is going to be talking about Nakba Day, talking about what happened yesterday and what's continuing to happen today. But if you would, and what we would like to open this segment, to just frame the issue for our audience here in the Washington, D.C. area and other U.S. cities who won't know what actually happened when the so-called State of Israel was formed and what actually happened to the Palestinians and why this is called the Day of Catastrophe.
Well, many Americans will have heard the mythical version that Israel's propagandists and indeed, you know, many American media have repeated for decades, sort of the Exodus film version, which is that, you know, on May 14th, 1948, the State of Israel was declared, and then all these surrounding Arab states invaded Israel in order to strangle it at birth. And as an unfortunate result of this war, the Arabs had started, you know, some Palestinians maybe became refugees and tough luck. Of course, the reality is that by this date, May 15th, 1948, 440,000 Palestinians had already been ethnically cleansed from their homes in the months before the State of Israel was declared. And when the Arab armies made their ineffectual intervention on this date 70 years ago, it made no difference to the outcome. Over the subsequent months, another 360,000 Palestinians would be ethnically cleansed from their homes. And that would be the beginning of the modern crisis that continues to this day, what Palestinians call the Nakba. The Nakba is the destruction of Palestine, the deliberate planned destruction by the Zionist militias who understood that they could not establish a Jewish state in a country where there was a majority that was not Jewish, that was Palestinian, Muslim, and Christian. And so that's what happened. And what we see now in Gaza is Palestinian refugees saying, we want to go back to our homes. We haven't forgotten. We haven't let go of our rights. And Israel denies them the right to go home. In fact, shoots them dead if they try, solely because they're not Jewish. That is the ongoing Nakba today.
Again, for our audience, which may not know, the State of Israel says the Jewish people who have never been to Palestine, have never been there at all, let's say they're living in Cleveland, they're living in Brooklyn, that they have this foundational, fundamental, biblically, you know, divined right to return. But the 700,000 plus, and now we have several generations more, so we're talking about millions of refugees, Palestinians, who have lived there for thousands and thousands of years, they will be gunned down, they will be shot down if they make even a symbolic gesture as if they're returning to the villages from which they and homes from which they were expelled. I mean, it's such an Alice in Wonderland, sort of everything tipped upside down. And again, because the corporate-owned media in America is so dominating, this narrative actually has a lot of traction, except I wonder, Ali, when people see Israel, I mean, this sort of disgusting spectacle where you have party-goers and rich people and billionaires like Sheldon Adelson or Jared Kushner or Ivanka Trump, celebrating at the same time you have all of these people, unarmed demonstrators, just being shot down like animals. I mean, it must have a profound impact on world public opinion, no matter how much the Western media tries to conceal it. Anyway, what's your view on that?
I think that's absolutely right. I was just in Dublin, Ireland over the weekend. There was a Palestine Freedom Conference, and it was really heartening to be there because the feeling of solidarity in Ireland is so strong. And it was opened by the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Michael McDonagher, who just himself a few weeks ago was banned by Israel from entering because of his support for Palestinian rights. And, you know, Michael McDonagher called for a boycott, full support for the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. A Dublin City Council just a few weeks ago became the first European capital to endorse the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It says to remember, boycott, you know, the Israel lobby tries to demonize it, but this is an honorable tactic that goes back to the civil rights movement in the U.S. Of course, international boycott was crucial in ending apartheid in South Africa. And, you know, Israel and its lobby are trying to turn boycott tactics, nonviolent civil protest, into some kind of dirty word, almost akin to terrorism. So it was amazing to be in Ireland and feel that solidarity at this moment. And that movement is definitely growing. And I think that in the wake of this horrific massacre in Gaza, especially when people see the images of, you know, Ivanka acting as if, you know, everything is just great, Netanyahu calling yesterday a glorious day for Israel as tens of people were gunned down in cold blood, more than 1,400 people shot with live ammunition. It produces disgust in people, real visceral disgust. And I think on top of that is the fact that the political class in this country and in Europe is already so out of touch with people. So they see, you know, the U.S. government, European governments refusing to condemn what Israel is doing. And they know that these governments are not speaking for them. So, yes, I do think that that popular grassroots movement is growing rapidly. We feel it. We see it. And we need it. The Palestinians are saying that, you know, I mean, they're being told you can't do armed struggle. You can't do boycott, divestment, and sanctions. You can't even protest. You can't even march symbolically to return home or simply to protest without being gunned down. So Palestinians are being told surrender or die. And that's not a choice that any people that values its lives will ever make.
Ali, there was a very provocative statement today by Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She said two things. First, she said this, quote, "Let's remember that the Hamas terrorist organization has been inciting violence for years, long before the United States decided to move our embassy. This is what is endangering the people of Gaza. Make no mistake, Hamas is pleased with the results from yesterday," unquote. She also congratulated the Israeli government for the restraint that it has used, she said, in Gaza. Now, the reason I'm even mentioning this is that across the country today and yesterday, in the mainstream media, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, the broadcast networks, they echo that theme that this is a failed terrorist attempt by Hamas, that the Israelis have pushed it back, and that the Israelis are to be congratulated. How do we get beyond that false narrative?
Yeah, her statements are utterly reprehensible, depraved statements, I would say. And of course, this is an old tactic of trying to blame Palestinians for their own deaths. And, you know, Hamas didn't exist before the early 1990s. So, you know, Hamas is a product of this conflict, not the cause of it. Hamas also, by the way, you know, Palestinians have been lectured for years, for decades, adopt nonviolent, adopt mass civil disobedience, don't use armed struggle. Why wouldn't you applaud Hamas for supporting protests where it's a mass mobilization of people? Isn't that what people wanted to see? The propaganda coming out of Nikki Haley's mouth, out of the Israelis, it has a simple goal. It's to demonize Palestinians, to paint people who are demanding their human rights as terrorists in order to justify murdering them. It's as simple as that. And what I, you know, and despite the media, you made this point. What I'm seeing is that people are getting it. The reactions I'm seeing, even from a lot of mainstream people on social media, is that they get it. They see this massacre and they know that it can't be right, no matter what the U.S. government says. And I think it's precisely because the Trump administration is embracing this Israeli massacre so tightly that is in some sense having the opposite effect, because, you know, there's kind of a Trump effect in that a lot of people are more willing to criticize things, sadly, when Trump embraces them. But if that's what it takes, okay.
Yeah, and I was also interested, John, because we had a small protest right after the show was mm-hmm. recorded yesterday. We went over to the White House with a number of activists. But the thing that it wasn't a big demonstration, but the tourists all were stopping. They were in front of the White House. That's where they go. They were all stopping and listening to the talks as we talked about what was going on. It wasn't like either apathy or opposition. People were like listening. This was something that I thought it was, there was a kind of a changed mood on it.
That's unusual.
If we can't talk about this now, in a way, you could never talk about it because nothing this gross recently has been this apparent to so many people in spite of the lying efforts of Nikki Haley and, of course, the corporate-owned media that functions as an echo chamber for Israeli propaganda. Anyway, Ali Abu Nima has been our guest. Ali is in Amman today. He is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. I urge people to go to that website. What's the web address, Ali?
Just search for Electronic Intifada or go to electronicintifada.net. And you can also find us on Twitter at Intifada, INTIFADA, or also on Facebook.
And Ali is also the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Now we're joined from Amman, Jordan, by Daoud Kutab. He is an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Daoud, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you for having me.
Nakba, 70 years ago today, and yet it's not 70 years ago. It continues. The catastrophe continues.
It started before 70 years, and unfortunately, it continues almost not a single day of happiness for many people, including especially people in Gaza, who basically have lost hope. They've lost any kind of faith in the world, in the peace process, in the ability of one day having freedom to live and walk and move and travel and go fishing in their own waters and dig their own wells and so on. The situation is totally unbearable. And what makes you even, you know, cringe is the way some of the media is sort of writing about it. Some of the U.S. and Israeli almost identical lies and statements are trying to kind of confuse the public as to what is happening. All of these things have to be debunked one by one and explained. And if you have time, I want to explain each one of them and debunk it.
Go ahead.
Well, first, the Americans and the Israelis are saying this is a Hamas-incited violence. You know, first of all, the pictures, you know, speak louder than words. Have you seen any Hamas flags? Have Hamas, you know, if they did this, why wouldn't they take credit for it? I mean, they're not known to be shy about taking credit for what they do. And there's not a single Hamas flag. Nobody in Hamas is saying it was theirs. This is something that was done by a higher committee. I mean, Hamas might be involved in it, and certainly Hamas probably could have stopped it, but it's not a Hamas-instigated act at all. Secondly, if it was Hamas, I think the Americans and the Israelis should be rejoicing. What better to have Hamas launch rockets to Sderot or to have unarmed people protesting? What's better for Israel? Why complain that Hamas was behind it? It just doesn't make any sense. So this is one issue that I think needs to be debunked in many circles. So the second argument is that this was done in self-defense. The Israelis, the poor Israelis, their lives are in danger, their country is in danger, and they did this to protect themselves and their country. I mean, hogwash. What Israelis were injured? What Israelis were killed? What Israeli soldiers? I mean, there are Israelis, you know, bunkered behind a hill with snipers that can shoot hundreds of meters away and picking off people right, left, and center. Whose life was in danger? Not a single Israeli was injured. Not a single Israeli soldier was killed. Nobody was injured. It's not a war. It's not a clash. This is a one-sided killing machine that's just picking off people and killing them right, left, and center. So this idea that this was the act of self-defense is so ridiculous, so unbelievable. And then you have the media, you know. The media is saying 59 Palestinians died. You know, excuse me, you know, was there an earthquake that I didn't hear about? Did, you know, was there an epidemic? You had a health epidemic that people died, or did somebody kill them? You know, to say 59 Palestinians died is so passive and so unbelievably, not true. You know, people didn't die. Somebody killed them. And I'm researching, I don't know if you remember the Gandhi film when the Chicago Tribune reporter was saying, you know, how people were being shot and
right.
dying, falling one after the other. What happened to that kind of great American reporting? Now 59 Palestinians died. You know, you know, there was a priest, for a Jesuit priest, is saying they were killed, they didn't die, and so you have this total whitewashing of the crime, a real crime of war that is happening, and they're saying, you know, this is something that is done in self defense. Finally, you know, the connection between Jerusalem and Gaza. Okay, now. What was happening in Jerusalem, the celebration of the unilateral decision by the Trump administration to move an embassy to break and to violate international agreements. People in Gaza read the news. They understand what's happening. They understand that by basically taking, as Trump said, Jerusalem off the table, they're basically saying there's no peace process anymore. I mean, there are five areas that were delayed for permanent status negotiations. Israel accepted that they would negotiate with the Palestinians as part of the Oslo Agreement on five permanent status issues. Two of them, Jerusalem and the refugees, were now suddenly off the table. So if you're a Palestinian in Gaza, 11 years of siege, and you see the embassies moving, the Americans and the Israelis are so happy and celebrating, what gives you hope? You ask any peacemaker anywhere in the world, what's the number one thing you need to do? And they'll tell you, give people a horizon. Give them people a political horizon. Give them something to be hopeful about. Otherwise, they'll explode. So you remove the hope, you remove any kind of a peace process, and you expect people to just, you know, send flowers to West Jerusalem or to Trump and his family. It's just so it makes you boil to say this is, you know, the move of the embassy is really a step towards peace.
Daoud Kotab is our guest. We're speaking to Daoud from Amman, Jordan, about the massacre yesterday and the continuing protests and of unarmed people and the continued repression, violent, brutal repression of them. As Daoud is making the point, John, people didn't die.
No.
The shameful and shameless Western media,
yeah.
People died. And again, using the narrative over and over and over again that somehow Hamas, like, scripted this whole thing.
Yeah, it's a conspiracy, of course.
Yeah.
Hamas conspired to trick the rest of the world by pretending that these people are not Hamas members, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's all ridiculous.
And, you know, the New York Times ran an op-ed yesterday, I think, by one of the founders of this. And the quote, you know, he said, I started this peace process there. And they have a bio. And they said, you know, this guy is who started, one of the people who started. They didn't say he's Hamas, and he's not Hamas. So if the New York Times, the paper of record, actually ran an op-ed by one of the guys who actually instigated and began the march, the Great March, why are you saying Hamas? You know, is the New York Times lying? I mean, is the New York Times bio not true? How had anybody questioned this op-ed that ran in the New York Times 2 days ago or yesterday? No one has questioned it.
Daoud, I mentioned to somebody else on another segment in the show that the BBC was actually forcing people who had been shot badly, badly wounded, about to be airlifted to Egypt for surgery, asking them, did Hamas make you come? I mean, why would that be the question? I mean, because Israeli propaganda is in the Western media, which functions as its echo chamber, is so powerful that even the wounded, those who are suffering, those who might die, are asked, unarmed people who were shot down like dogs by Israeli snipers, did Hamas make you do this? It's just, and of course, the person responded and said, no, we came because we were protesting occupation. We're protesting what Trump did in Jerusalem.
Times of Israel today has a piece in which they actually have a quote by the reporter saying, one of the men of Hamas, dressed in civilian clothes, was asking people to go home, was asking people not to demonstrate. The total opposite of the statement. So, look. you know, again, I say, if Hamas is behind the nonviolent protests, you know, why isn't anybody thanking them for not shooting rockets? Why isn't somebody saying, okay, you know, fine, you know, at least this is something we can deal with. You know, in our countries, people also protest and people throw firebombs and throw stones at police and nobody gets shot and killed, you know, mown down the way the Israeli snipers killed these Palestinians. So whether it's Hamas or not actually is totally immaterial. And as I say, I think the world community should celebrate if Hamas has stopped launching rockets and now believe in unarmed, nonviolent protests.
Dawood is right. The whole question is irrelevant. What's relevant is that there are heavily armed Israeli troops firing across a border that they created at unarmed people and killing them with impunity. That's the issue here.
Yeah, and the rules of engagement are so macabre. You see, like, if somebody's throwing a rock, you can shoot them below the thighs.
Right.
You can blow up their legs. If somebody's doing something else, you can shoot them here. It's all of these complicated rules of engagement. But the snipers are in a calm position. They're not under siege.
No.
They're not being pressured. They just decide, okay, we're going to shoot this person. We're going to shoot that person. And meanwhile, the Western media yawns and says...
No, they don't decide. They are ordered. There's somebody, there's war criminals in Tel Aviv in the Ministry of Defense that is ordering them to kill. They don't just shoot. They are ordered by their own war criminals, whether it's Lieberman or Netanyahu or anybody down the line. They're ordered to shoot, and both the shooter and the one who ordered them must be taken to the high international court for crimes of war.
Yeah, Dawood Kotab is our guest. Dawood has won several international awards. He's a filmmaker. In 1996, he was granted the International Press Freedom Award of the U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists. Dawood, I'm just wondering, because of the grotesque character of what happened, whether or not this Nakba, this day, this anniversary could be in some ways like sort of turning the corner. I mean, is Israel now so thoroughly exposed that the dynamics of world public opinion and the dynamics of the struggle as a consequence of the change of world public opinion, are we now reaching that kind of a point?
You know, I wrote a book called Sesame Street in Palestine, and now I'm trying to write a new book. And one of the ideas I want in a book is about the overreach. Israel is powerful. It's so powerful. Its economy is really doing very well. And, you know, the Israelis are drunk with power. They're literally drunk with power. They are so powerful. They are so well protected. They have, there's a T-shirt that's sold in the old city saying, U.S., don't worry, Israel is behind you, you know. They are, they can say and do anything the same way that Trump said, you know, he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, nobody will do anything to him. And the Israelis are like that. They can do anything. They can get away with literally murder, and they are getting away with murder.
Dawood, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined from Amman, Jordan, by award-winning filmmaker Dawood Kotab. He, as I said, is a journalist. He's won many, many awards. Dawood, thanks so much. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series every Tuesday, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. We're talking to him from Northern California, from the San Francisco area. Daniel Sankey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
You know, one of the important reasons we do this show is because the economy affects everyone. As we always say, it affects our ability to live. It affects where we live. It affects how our children are doing. And yet, when it comes to economic issues, the stories are always like in the business and finance section of the newspapers. And people generally feel, I can't understand what's going on with the economy, except maybe in specific terms, in terms of how it impacts them. That's why it's important to do this show. And Daniel, we have a number of issues that you flagged during the course of the week that we want to talk about. Let's Let's start right now with the headline that you submitted. Now hiring for a one-day job, the gig economy hits retail. One, what is the gig economy? How many people are impacted by it? And what does it mean that it's now, quote, hitting retail?
So the gig economy, for people who maybe aren't familiar with it, was really kind of pioneered by companies like Uber and Lyft. And the idea is that these new companies would really be hiring a very temporary, almost contract work. So as an Uber, quote unquote, you know, employee or driver, and Uber is very clear, you are not an employee if you're a driver, because there's all sorts of obligations they have to you if you are an employee. You start working for them the moment you start driving, and then immediately stop working for them the moment you stop driving. And they give you a percentage of whatever fares. There's no stability in that job. You could get a lot of rides one day, or you could get no rides. And if you get no rides, then you don't make much money at all. There's no health insurance. There's no pension plan. There's no benefits. And it's really just pay to drive. And what this article is talking about is how that model is spreading to other companies, especially those in retail. And even, you know, based on my conversations with some others, even the restaurant industry, where they're just having temporary waiters, waitresses, service staff for just a day or two. What this is doing is it's impacting potentially, you know, millions of people. We know there's a lot of Uber drivers here in the U.S., but, you know, worldwide, really, they're all over the place, where these different platforms are creating this temporary labor, where people have no stability in their particular job function. So there's these different tech companies like Snagwork or Lyft or Uber or TaskRabbit, and their job is really to connect temporary, very temporary workers with people who need a little temporary help. So it's a totally unstable form of employment. And of course, the tech company makes sure to say, hey, we're not an employer, so we have no obligations to these people, and we're just connecting you with another employer. And that's all we do. And of course, they get a percentage, and they make a lot of money doing it. And so this is a very attractive model to employers, because, of course, you can grind down wages, you can grind down benefits. If you're a temporary worker, why would you report sexual harassment, you know, if you're just going to be replaced the next day? Why would you report being underpaid or you know, paid below minimum wage? Why would you report unsafe work conditions? They literally don't even have to fire you. Your shift just expires at the end of the night, and then they'll never hire you again. So it's hugely disempowering to workers and really puts them at risk, and their benefits and their income at tremendous pressure.
It's really totally changed the vernacular, too. When we were growing up, the word gig meant a job that a band was going to play on Saturday night in a nightclub or something. Now it has a whole different meaning. And I wanted to say, too, I've used TaskRabbit a couple of times. It never really occurred to me that that was a part of the gig economy. Of course it is. But I've used it for things like I bought my kids a trampoline. I'm a Luddite when it comes to using tools. And so I just hired a guy to come to the house and put the trampoline together. And he did a great job, and I paid him, and that was the end of it, which is great for me. But as Daniel points out, this guy only has that job and whatever other job he's able to download from whatever website he's using. In that case, it was TaskRabbit. He has no health insurance. There's no employer that's withholding taxes, so his taxes are going to be that much more difficult at the end of the year. With all of that said, all of those problems, Daniel, is this the future?
It certainly is the future that these corporations want to create. I mean, you know, they make it sound like it's a little side job to make some extra money, implying that you have some kind of main job that's providing a real living income. But the truth is, if retail and restaurant, you know, industry, which are massive industries in the U.S., employing millions of people, start jumping on board with this, this will become more of a standard. You know, you talk about a gig being, you know, a band playing for one night, for one set. That's exactly the point they're trying to make. This is a one night, one set deal. You're not here for the long term. And what it really does is it, you know, decimates unions, because there's not a consistent group of workers that can organize. They're completely and constantly shifted out. And really what it shows is how all these companies kind of waited on the sidelines while Uber and Lyft went after this model. And they wanted to see, what would regulators do? What would the people do? What kind of pushback would there be? And the reality is they were very effective in lobbying legislators who really didn't do anything about it, who didn't force them to make drivers employees or force them to engage in some sort of registration or regulated practice. They just kind of stood at the sidelines and maybe clicked their tongues a little bit, but allowed them to say, these aren't employees and we owe them absolutely nothing, even though they're making us billions of dollars. So now retailers and those like them are saying, well, hey, if it's working for Uber and this legal precedent is being set, we're going to go after it too. Let's get our own little apps. You know, Walmart could have its own app where you'd get temporary work at Walmart. I mean, they certainly have a huge lift and a huge reach. Target could do something similar to that. And I can definitely see them moving in that direction as a way of really maximizing profitability at the cost of just grinding down workers' benefits.
I'm looking also farther down in this article that appeared in today's Washington Post. Snag, previously called Snag-a-Job, it's also called Snag Work now, is the app that most of these jobs run through. This is an Arlington, Virginia-based tech company, and it's only existed for, what, a year. It's already built a multi-million dollar business, saying that it helps job seekers find and apply for low-wage, keywords there, low-wage hourly work on their phones. So the reporter who wrote this article gave it a try just to see what was out there. And what was out there were mostly non-skilled, unskilled jobs, a room attendant, for example, at a Marriott hotel, a cashier at a Potbelly's restaurant, grill cook at Five Guys hamburger place. And they only pay between $8.25 an hour and $10 an hour. So it's not like this is something that's going to help you build a career. If you've got kids at home and you need to put food on the table, it might help you do that in the very short term. But this is not something that's going to help you really become a consistently well-contributing member of the economy.
And also, you know, when you think about what actually happens to people, people get sick and people get hurt, for instance. Like that happens. John, you
that's
were,
right.
When you started this job, you had an auto accident,
yeah.
A motorcycle accident. You were out for...
Almost killed myself.
Yeah. And you almost did kill yourself.
Yeah.
And you were out for like 6 weeks.
Yep.
Let's say you're a gig worker.
Right.
And you something happens. You have an accident. You're not able to get any income for 6 weeks. You don't have health care. And you have some kids.
Right.
You're a single mom or a single dad and you have some kids.
And it's literally impossible then for you to put food on the table.
Yeah. And then you can't pay your rent. People in this layer of the economy are just a week or two away from having a catastrophic inability to pay rent or mortgage.
That's right.
And you're on the streets. America has, among industrialized nations, the largest number of homeless families anywhere. And 34% of the homeless in America are homeless families. It's because of the, quote, gig economy, partly. Go ahead, Daniel.
I think it's really important when you talk about that. The vast majority of Americans are, a month's worth of paychecks away from total poverty and destitution. They're right on the edge. Most people don't have more than $500 in a savings account. Most have much less. And then, you know, you talk about getting sick or getting injured. That is a natural part of human life. It's not like getting sick or getting injured is optional or the result of someone being negligent or something like that. We get sick. It's part of being a living being. And the fact that this natural part of human life should result in total destitution, in total, you know, poverty because you missed a month's worth of work to go from a, you know, relatively stable, decent life with your family to, you know, living on the streets in a tent, you know, is absurd. And that's exactly the direction things like the gig economy go in. You know, you talk about this company Snagwork. I'll bet all the engineers and designers there wouldn't appreciate being a day-to-day employed with Snagwork. What if Snagwork said to all of them, hey, we're going to hire you for on a daily basis and we'll get rid of you at the end of the day if we choose to, or we'll keep you on? Of course not. They would expect benefits. They would expect options. They would expect a 401k. They would expect, you know, high pay because they would never submit to the type of working conditions that their particular tool designs. because they know how unpleasant, insecure, and, you know, dangerous and exploitative it is. So it's really, you know, hypocritical that they sit there and try to say, oh, we're connecting people with each other. We're helping them get work, when really all they're doing is just helping grind down work even more.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Where every Tuesday we talk about the big economic issues, those economic issues that are widely ignored by the mainstream media. Daniel, let's go on to another story. Take us to the next place.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things I wanted to talk a little bit about that was suggested to me is regarding the GOP tax overhaul, which is not so very far behind us, and specifically a particular aspect of it, which has doubled the amount of real estate tax exemptions to 22 million from before about 11 million. And what that simply means is that when people pass on their property to their heirs, they can pass on even more tax-free when it comes to real estate than they were before. You know, this article singles out real estate, which is substantial, but also just in terms of cash and assets, they can actually pass on a lot more. And so really what we're seeing is a law that is going to help create this sort of dynasty building where people are able to pass on fantastic wealth to their children, and the children, you know, have to do absolutely nothing about it, that there's no obligation to release that wealth back into society to benefit society as a whole, or to motivate the next generation to continue to, you know, innovate, create different things that stimulate the economy, different products and services, when they can just sit on it. And I think this is kind of the natural evolution of where we're seeing things go. Really, you know, in our society, we're seeing people in positions of extreme power who have no real skill or talent beyond the fact that they were born with tremendous wealth. And their ability to shape and move and shift society was because they inherited huge amounts from the generation before them. I think of our president as one example. I mean, can you imagine if he started with nothing, if he really would have risen to the heights of power that he has now? Absolutely not. You know, he's not particularly creative or clever or intelligent, but he is wealthy. And with that much money, you can make a name for yourself. You can go all the way to the top, and he certainly has. So there were these novels that was commented on in the book Capital in the 21st Century, which is a pretty interesting read, where they talked about, you know, in French society, it was this critique of French society back in the 1800s. And the question was, is it better to work hard, get an education and make money, or is it better to marry rich? And the book's very kind of cynical response, which was critiquing its society, was marry rich. There's absolutely no sense in trying to work hard at it. You'll never make enough money. And we're seeing a return to that, a sort of these dynasties, whether back in the old days they were dukedoms or fiefdoms or whatever, and we're seeing those develop now. This GOP tax plan will help accelerate that as people are able to pass on real estate and other assets to their progeny with far less tax implications.
I'm interested also, Daniel, in this idea of propping up the stock market and thus the economy with stock buybacks. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying that S&P 500 firms are on pace right now to reinvest $1 trillion. And the way it's couched is to return $1 trillion to shareholders by buying back their stocks. This happens all the time, but doesn't that just artificially inflate the value of stocks?
Yeah, it does a lot of things. So first of all, notice it's talking about the S&P 500, which is one index. There's also the NASDAQ and the Dow Jones. So this is actually a kind of a smaller segment of the very wealthy top firms. So a smaller segment is returning almost $1 trillion to stock buybacks. Keep in mind, the deficit that we've created with the tax cuts is about $1.5 trillion. So two-thirds so far in this year is going to be spent on stock buybacks. Now, what the heck are stock buybacks? Really, all they are is a company buying their shares back from their shareholders at a good price, and then destroying those shares, reducing the amount of them in supply, so artificially inflating their price, driving up their price. This is a very common practice and has become much more common in the last decade and a half. But we're seeing a huge explosion of it now because of the GOP tax plan. So these companies haven't actually produced more value. They haven't actually created items or services of value. All they've done is given a huge tax break, so at our expense, right, our money will be used to cover their shortfall. So they've taken money from people like you and I, and now they're using it to push up their stock prices, having produced nothing of value, not created a job, not opened a new factory, done nothing. And this creates tremendous instability in the market. I know the Wall Street Journal shows it as like helps steady a wobbly market. In the short term, sure, it steadies it. It causes these stock prices to inflate. But because it's not based on anything substantial, because these S&P firms haven't created a new iPhone, created a new search engine, created a new service that people are wild about and flocking to, all it does is artificially raise these prices, and it creates more market instability in the long run because there's not something substantial propping it up in the way of jobs or products or services.
Yeah, and Apple, you know, announced the buyback program for $100 billion to $310 billion of its own stock. I mean, that reduces the number of stocks, shares in circulation.
Yep, that's
in circulation. Drives the price up, is a handsome reward for the investors, and especially the biggest investors.
Which are the executives and the institutional investors.
Yeah. And then, again, one of the purposes, so-called, alleged, of the Trump tax plan was to get corporations like Apple, which, even though they're really U.S. corporations, park their headquarters overseas so that they don't have to pay taxes. It would be to bring them back. In other words, to have them have some parts of their profits here so that they could be taxed by the federal government. But is Apple, Daniel Senke, is it doing that?
No. In fact, it is buying back hundreds of billions of dollars of worth of shares. It's using a small portion of that repatriated funds to build a campus, and they make a big deal about it. A lot of fanfare, a lot of flag waving, saying, hey, we're building this huge campus here, which, of course, is just going to cause home prices to jack up even more and take away land that could be used to build housing to instead build a luxury campus for their tech workers. But that aside, it is a small fraction of the money they're bringing overseas. Because really, when you are Apple, you live and die on your share price. If your share price is up, nobody cares what the heck you're doing because you're making the money. And if your share price is down, then they're furious and they want to know what the heck you're doing about it. So if you have the ability to inflate your share price almost instantly, almost overnight, just by flooding the market with cash and taking back shares and destroying them, your investors like it, right? The executives at your company like it. They're getting cash. They're getting great preferred prices for their stock. And it's artificially inflating your share price. So you live and die per quarter. You're only as good as your last quarter. And if your profit rates drop from quarter to quarter, everyone's going to want to know what the heck's up with Apple. Why aren't they, you know, doing what they're supposed to do? So rather than think long-term plans, rather than think strategically, rather than think of designing things for the next 5, 10, 20 years, they're thinking about next quarter. And the fastest way you can get going next quarter is to do those share buybacks, which have no real tangible benefit in the economy. It's just a little trick of mathematics that helps rich people get even richer and drive up your stock price even more.
Daniel Senke is our guest. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Every week, we take a look at the big economic issues in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street corporate capitalism with Daniel Senke. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. You can hear this show, Loud and Clear, every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 1390 a.m. or 105.5 FM. You can also subscribe to us at iTunes. And John, you can also subscribe to us now at iHeartRadio.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah, we're expanding. And, of course, you can hear us at SputnikNews.com. Daniel Senke, let's go on to the next story.
Absolutely. So there was an article in the Wall Street Journal where they were talking about and trumpeting the current administration's addition of about 1,500 more work visas this summer so that lower-skilled workers could come from overseas, mostly from Latin America, to work in mostly the agricultural industry, because, of course, this is focused on the summer. And the Wall Street Journal is very excited. Normally only 66,000 come over, but they bumped it up a little bit under pressure from agribusiness and those that profit from it. And I think I really wanted to highlight this story because I think it's really important to understand this. You know, Trump was elected on this ultra anti-immigrant, ultra racist platform that they're taking our jobs and they're hurting us and they're destroying our economy, right? Yet what we're seeing right now is how absolutely essential these workers are for the continuation of one of the most fundamental aspects of our economy, which is the production of food. We need to eat. We need food to eat. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. And they're utterly dependent on these lowly paid workers. So really, when we talk about this racist rhetoric, we have to ask, what exactly is going on here? And what is going on here is that so long as these communities are under attack, so long as they exist in a sort of semi-legal status where they get to stay for the summer, but then they got to get the heck out of here, so long as, you know, organizations like ICE are in place, we can grind down their wages even more. I mean, how many of these, you know, visa workers are going to complain if they're in dangerous conditions where they can get injured or if they're sexually abused or something like that? You're going to be gone in a couple of months anyway. Nobody cares. And certainly this administration has made it very clear they do not care and will not be dedicating any resources to investigating claims like that. And yet, what you're also seeing is these wealthy agribusinesses desperate for these workers, drawing them in, pressuring the administration to raise the amount of visas they're providing. And I think it's really important to talk about that, that these immigrants not only are essential to the productive capacity of our economy for our ability to make food, but that they're also some of the most exploited and abused of these workers, given their pseudo-legal status under an incredibly aggressive, abusive administration. So I think we need to really consider when we talk about, you know, immigrants, when we talk about immigration, there's often this debate that's either pro or anti-immigrant. You know, we should have more immigrants, we should open the borders, or no, forget it, we should push them out. Really, we need to start talking about workers, of which immigrants are a good portion of them. And if we really care about immigrants, if we think that they matter and that they don't deserve the abuse and racism from this administration, then we also need to talk about how they're treated when they are here in these pseudo-legal states, because they are some of the most exploited workers and people. If we're going to argue for the freedom for them to move, to come to this country, we need to also talk about their working conditions, and we also need to address the super exploitation that they're under. So I think it's a bit dishonest and disingenuous in our current administration that there's this anti-immigrant rhetoric when they know full well how much they need immigrants, when they know it's not immigrants that are the problem, it's immigrants feeling like they're human beings, feeling like they should have rights, feeling like they have some kind of power when they're here. That is the threat that the Trump administration is seeking to counteract through its incredibly racist policies and rhetoric.
I had coffee this morning with a Greek citizen who has been living in the United States for 5 years. He's a senior manager at one of the big four accounting firms. So he's a professional, bachelor's and master's degrees from Georgetown University and a law degree from the University of London. So this isn't a guy who, you know, jumped over the side of the boat to try to sneak in here. He came on an H-1B visa. Well, he told me that because of the new visa restrictions implemented by the Trump administration, even if you have an H-1B visa now, you're enlisted in a lottery. And so your H-1B can be taken away from you at any time. Well, he's been here for 5 years. He's made friends. He bought a house. He has a job. And his visa was taken away from him. So he's leaving tomorrow and he's moving back to Greece, where he's going to try to build a new life. But in the meantime, as Daniel is pointing out right here, we can bring in all of the H-2B visa recipients we want to do what? To work in menial jobs where they're going to be abused and where they're going to get no benefits. They're going to be waitresses and waiters. They're going to be lifeguards at swimming pools. And indeed,
at Mar-a-Lago too.
I was just going to say, if this summer is just like last summer, there are going to be dozens and dozens of them working at Mar-a-Lago for the minimum wage. This is what the visa program has become in this country. You know, we say we want to encourage highly educated, highly technical and skilled workers to this country, and that's just simply not true. What we want is unskilled laborers, because they'll do the jobs that Americans don't want to take.
Absolutely. And a lot of this policy, John, when you talk about the lottery portion of it, really it is to frighten off immigrants from even trying to be here legally. Even if they're here legally, and you're totally unstable from 1 year to the next, you might have to pick up anything. Are you going to really have a stable job? Are you going to get married? Are you going to have kids? Are you going to start establishing a life when you know, hey, you know, next year, maybe this all goes up in smoke? The point is to intimidate and frighten and make it as unpleasant as possible for immigrants so they don't even try. So even, you know, like the Muslim ban, which I don't think he ever intended to really go through all the way, the point was to terrify people, and boy, did it work. So that even if it isn't implemented in the way it's supposed to be, the other immigrants say, wow, I got to stay the heck out of there. This is just too dangerous for me.
Daniel, we have 3 minutes left. Another story, Wall Street Journal. Economists think the next U.S. recession could begin in 2020. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I wanted to talk briefly about recessions. We talked about all those stock buybacks just a moment ago and how it creates all this instability, all this artificially inflated prices. The last huge economic crisis we had was 10 years ago, and these things tend to move cyclically roughly every 10 years. You know, the economy is booming. The tech sector is hugely overinflated. Workers' wages are way down, which is to say that the demand for goods and services is way down. That's a huge indicator because really that's what's going to prop up and create any stable economy is aggregate demand, people buying services and goods. The whole episode segment has been about how workers' ability to buy goods and services is being ground down. So we need to really look at that. You know, the Fed is going to be raising interest rates, which means all this artificial investment from these incredibly low interest rates is going to be slowly ebbing and going away. So that's the point of a balloon, right? You need to have all these artificial ways of pumping it up and making it look bigger than it really is. Stock buybacks, low interest rates, quantitative easing. And as those things roll back, as the Fed pulls them back, as it must eventually, we're going to see some serious downfall and downturn. And I think, yeah, 2020 is sounds about right. Maybe a little earlier, but I could see definitely a recession starting in 2020. That is the nature of, you know, a market economy. It's going to move anarchistically, it's going to move in cycles, and it's going to be extremely unstable. So I wanted to kind of bring that up to show that there is tremendous instability in how we choose to produce wealth, to choose to distribute wealth and goods and services in our economy. And there's all these very kind of creative accounting ways of pumping and propping it up that are, you know, somewhat dishonest. So I think it's important to discuss that as we start thinking about how we use wealth as a society. Do we want to continue to have a society that's constantly built on cyclical instability from one day to the next, from one year to the next, or do we want something that is stable, that works for people, that provides them the basic things they need to live and prosper and thrive?
Excellent point. The business cycle, the boom-bust cycle, it's not mandated by a divine authority. It's particular to a particular economic system, and that, of course, has a lot to do with choices that all of us can make. Again, that's all the time we have. We've been joined by Daniel Sankey in this segment of False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.